Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, join Stanford historians James Sheehan and David Kennedy for the Cold War and its legacies, exploring the global impact of this pivotal era. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
MATLAB and Simulink Software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Scott Tong. This is Here and Now. Coming up, a retired military lawyer on the legality of the Trump administration's strikes on presumed drug boats.
Also, bacon from a pig that's still alive and well.
I'm eating Dawn the Yorkshire pig, and she's quite tasty. But don't worry, she's doing perfectly fine, traipsing around a sanctuary in upstate New York.
We'll explain what that's all about.
And hackers are using AI to write and send phishing emails and to improve their malicious software.
We would see that their malware would change, so it was being like rapidly developed. Complete new functionality, new ways of communicating. And they did it really quickly.
Coming up here now.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Somalia's prime minister is downplaying President Trump's derogatory comments about his country and Somalis living in the U.S. Trump said yesterday he does not want Somali immigrants in America. Emmanuel Agunza has more.
Somali Prime Minister Hamza Abdi Barre said Mogadishu will not elevate Trump's comments and that it would be best to ignore them, as he had recently made similar remarks against other African countries. Last month, Trump said he will end temporary protected status for many Somalis living in Minnesota, saying without evidence that Somali gangs were terrorizing the state. The Trump administration this week also announced it was pausing immigration applications, such as requests for green cards for people from 19 countries, the majority from African nations, including Somalia, Chad, Republic of Congo, Equatorial Guinea, Eritrea, Libya, Sudan, and others. The pause follows the shooting of two National Guard troops in Washington last week. For NPR News, I'm Emmanuel Igunza.
Democratic lawmakers have released new images and videos from one of Jeffrey Epstein's islands. NPR's Rachel Treisman reports the images appear to add no new or revealing information about Epstein or the trafficking of underage girls.
The footage was taken by U.S. Virgin Island authorities in 2020, the year after Epstein's death. It shows the pool, as well as several bedrooms, bathrooms, and common spaces, in one of several estates where Epstein is alleged to have abused and trafficked scores of underage girls. The rooms are furnished with writing and decor on the walls, but no people inside. Democrats unveiled the photos as they try to keep pressure on the Justice Department to release the full Epstein files. President Trump signed a measure compelling it to do so, with exceptions, by mid-December. Rachel Treisman, NPR News.
Billionaires Michael and Susan Dell have pledged more than $6 billion to encourage U.S. families to claim Trump accounts. The gift is designed to support a portion of the president's tax and spending bill that involves new investment accounts for kids. NPR's Stacey Vanek Smith explains the Trump accounts.
It really does function a little bit like a retirement account, where you can make tax-free contributions. The child's family, even an employer, can make contributions into these accounts. And then once the child turns 18, they can start withdrawing these accounts for things like a down payment on a house or education, things like that.
President Trump has said for babies born during the years 2025 through 2028, the Treasury Department would deposit $1,000 into each child's fund. That would total around $13 billion. At last check on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up more than 400 points, or roughly 1%, at 47,922. The S&P's up 26. The NASDAQ was up 58 points. You're listening to NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. A new study shows that last winter's massive battery plant fire near Monterey spread a layer of toxic metals across the region. KQED's Catherine Monahan reports.
Scientists from San Jose State University found sharp increases in nickel, manganese, and cobalt in the soil of Elkhorn Slough, a nearby wildlife refuge. The metals, which can be toxic to wildlife and humans, then dispersed with the rain and tides. Ivano Aiello is a professor and chair at Moss Landing Marine Laboratories.
Where it went is one of the good questions, right? Probably runoff took some of the metals in the waterways, but it didn't go completely away. In the longer term, what we are trying to understand is whether it's going to be transferred to the ecosystems.
Many agricultural fields are also close to the Moss Landing battery plant. Vistra Corporation, which operates the plant, did not return a request for comment. I'm Catherine Monahan, KQED News.
An AC transit bus crashed into a building in East Oakland, injuring 11 people yesterday afternoon. The crash took place on Foothill Boulevard and 68th Avenue shortly after 1 p.m. Transit officials say an SUV crossed in front of the bus, leading to a crash that sent the bus over a curb and into an auto body shop. Firefighters pulled the bus driver out through one of the vehicle's windows. The driver, 8 passengers on the bus, and 2 people in the SUV were hurt with minor injuries. San Jose Sharks back at the tank tonight hosting the Capitals. I'm Brian Watt. Thanks for listening to KQED News.
Afternoon support comes from Postman, offering a platform to assist teams build APIs to help API agents make decisions. Postman.com. Support for NPR comes from Bayer. Bayer is dedicated to delivering breakthroughs that save lives and feed the world using the scientific process. Learn more at sciencedelivers.com. And the listeners of KQED. Around the bay today, upper 50s to the mid-60s are the highs. King tide, coastal flood advisory in effect through Sunday afternoon. High surf sneaker waves along the coast. The beach hazard statement ends tonight. Gusty winds today around the bay. Some gusts up to 45, down to 35 miles per hour later in the afternoon and early evening.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. This is Here and Now. Navy Admiral Frank Mitch Bradley is expected to give a classified briefing tomorrow to select members of Congress about what happened September 2nd. The lawmakers are investigating a second strike that day on a presumed drug boat from Venezuela. Some are asking if the actions constitute a war crime. There are differing accounts of the second strike. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said Admiral Bradley ordered it. In a cabinet meeting yesterday, Hegseth said the commander-in-chief gave full authority to military commanders.
President Trump has empowered commanders, to do what is necessary, which is dark and difficult things in the dead of night on behalf of the American people. We support them.
And Hegseth blamed the fog of war for that second strike, which killed 2 survivors. He noted he was not in the room to watch the second strike. Let's discuss now some legal questions with Jeffrey Korn. He served in the Army for 21 years and is now the chair of criminal law and director of the Center for Military Law and Policy at Texas Tech University's School of Law. Jeffrey, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
When the Admiral briefs Congress, what in your view are the most important questions to ask?
Well, the most important question is, what was your order from the Secretary of Defense and how did you understand the scope of your mission? The next question, I think, is, did the Secretary make the statement, kill them all? If he did he make it before the first strike or after the first strike? Because if he made it after the first strike, it's far more problematic. Even if he didn't make it, were you able to observe the survivors after the first strike? What was the military necessity for ordering the second strike? What was your target during the second strike? Were you attacking the boat or were you trying to kill the survivors? Those are critical questions. Yeah. And why, if you attacked the boat, was it not possible to rescue the survivors?
To rescue, yeah. Professor, I want to play another part of the cabinet meeting yesterday and get your reaction. Here again is Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth.
So the president had the courage to designate these cartels as designated terrorist organizations. Now, a number of us here served in the military and spent 20 years fighting terrorists like Al-Qaeda and ISIS on the other side of the world. How do you treat Al-Qaeda and ISIS? Do you arrest them and treat them, pat them on the head and say, don't do that again? Or do you end the problem directly by taking a lethal, kinetic approach? And that's the way President Trump has authorized the War Department to look at these cartels.
Yeah, and this goes to the Trump administration's legal argument here that the crew were part of a drug cartel, Tren de Aragua, which the administration argues is conducting irregular warfare, sending drugs that kill Americans. So why can't they be deemed terrorists, non-state actors, in your view?
Well, actually, I think that statement is far more troubling than the issue of the second strike on the boat, because what it reveals is a flawed interpretation of international law that treats what is essentially a criminal problem as a wartime problem. And comparing Al-Qaeda or ISIS with Tren de la Ragua is like comparing a musket with a Tomahawk cruise missile. They're completely different. The goal of Al-Qaeda was to kill Americans and harm Americans abroad. That was their intent. There's no evidence that Tren de la Ragua is attacking the United States. Importing illegal drugs is a bad thing, and it should be addressed vigorously through criminal law mechanisms. But simply saying that the president has a right to designate any criminal gang as a wartime threat is opening a Pandora's box that I think we will ultimately regret.
Yeah, and I gather the importance of criminal law here is that criminal suspects would be, you'd arrest them, put them on trial, give them due process. But as you know, some are arguing we're in this new gray area of groups somewhere in between crime and war. Non-state groups like the pirates off Somalia, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, the Houthis. Is there a gray area here?
I have been one of the strongest advocates on a very pragmatic interpretation of international law and the meaning of armed conflict to deal with non-state, transnational, organized groups. But the pragmatism of that interpretation is not endless or unlimited. The key here that your listeners should think about is, have we seen anything from this drug cartel that would indicate normal law enforcement response mechanisms are incapable of dealing with the threat? When a plane is being flown into the Twin Towers, the New York Police Department doesn't have the capability to defend the United States against it. But the Navy and the Coast Guard are fully capable of maritime interdiction operations to search vessels and arrest the individuals who are engaged in criminal conduct. And we should not, as a nation, have invoked the authority to kill people as a measure of first resort.
All right. Jeffrey Korn is law professor at Texas Tech University. He served in the Army for 21 years. Jeffrey, professor, thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
A Republican won a special election yesterday for a House seat in Middle Tennessee. So why isn't the party celebrating? Well, it's because Matt Van Epps only beat his liberal challenger by 9 points in a district that President Trump won by 22 points last year. Last night, the congressman-elect had a message for the people he called professional panickers in his own party.
Tonight we showed running from Trump is how you lose. Running with Trump is how you win.
John Geer is back to put those election results into context. He's a political science professor in pollster at Vanderbilt University. John, nice to speak with you again.
Nice to talk with you again.
When we had you on Monday to talk about this election, you told us that Van Epps was likely to win. The question was, by how much? So what do you think of the margins here?
Well, I think the margins are part of what we're seeing nationally. You see basically a, 12-13 point shift towards the Democrats. You've seen that in New Jersey. You've seen that in Virginia, Georgia, elsewhere. And here in Tennessee, Ruby Red, Tennessee, in that district was a 22 point district for Trump. It's down to 9 for Van Epps. And that's, part of the broader narrative. This narrative that came out of the early November elections is just going to continue. The Republicans are staring into, a troubled 2026.
You say troubled, but what would happen, do you know, nationally if other Republican-held districts saw a 13-point swing like this one?
Oh, it's just massive. The Democrats would take the House back with some ease, and it might spill over enough that the Democrats could even take the Senate back. The Van Epps comments that you played just a minute or so before highlights the problems that the Republican Party faces, because Van Epps uses that speech to basically flatter Trump. And the truth of the matter is that Trump's the problem, and this district reflects that. You want to take advantage of Trump's coattails, but they aren't there yet. But you can't distance yourself, because that'll just lead to all kinds of different attacks by the MAGA wing of the party. So Republicans are in a tough position.
Could you make an argument, as some Republicans have, that a special election in an off year is an isolated case? It doesn't really say much about where things are headed.
Well, you can make that argument, but there's two problems with it. Usually in a kind of a special election, low turnout election, you're going to have the base, the MAGA base turnout. So it doesn't quite ring true. But this is part of a broader pattern. You see a big, you know, 10 to 13 point shift across the board. It doesn't matter what county, what precinct you're referring to, that if Van Epps more accurately had been able to capture this seat by 15 to 20 points, then that narrative might have some appeal. But right now, the pattern is pretty clear.
Let's talk about the Democrat in this race, a progressive, Afton Bain. She made the election about affordability and President Trump, and she's no moderate. I mean, she calls herself a very radical person. This was something that Republicans tried to capitalize on, and she spoke about the results last night.
And although tonight is not the final result of what we wanted, but it is the beginning of something so powerful in Tennessee and across the South.
So, John, are Democrats looking at this race and thinking, well, geez, maybe if we ran a moderate this time or if we run a moderate next year, we might have a better chance of winning in Tennessee?
You know, that's certainly going to be one interpretation. In this low turnout environment that we saw with the special election, you know, Bain was clearly able to get some turnout going, especially in Davidson County. I mean, she won the early vote in Davidson County, 85-15, key part of Nashville, and that's a huge you know, win. And it obviously didn't translate to carrying the district, but it certainly woke people up when you saw that kind of a number. You know, what Afton Bain was able to do was to say, look, cost of living matters. We have lots of data that shows it's on the rise. This is a problem for the Republican Party. Trump promised to fix it and he hasn't. And there's going to be, you know, accountability come November of 2026 if this problem has not been solved. And we, you know, we can't be sure of the crystal ball, but the economy doesn't seem quite ready to give up inflation.
Well, look, the president said something really interesting yesterday about affordability at the White House during a cabinet meeting yesterday. Let's listen.
You know, there's this fake narrative that the Democrats talk about affordability. They just say the word. It doesn't mean anything to anybody.
So what do you think Republicans do now? Do they have to find the right message around affordability to help their chances going into the midterms?
They not only have to find the right message, but they actually have to take advantage of certain policies, and in particular figuring out how to deal with health care without jacking up premiums. That's going to be a big problem. But they want to do away with Obamacare, but at the same time, that's going to keep premiums down, so they're facing that. The tariff situation is going to continue to put pressure, upward pressure on inflation. You know, Trump's statement about affordability is a Democratic talking point. You know, that's just not true. I mean, we have clear data that even MAGA Republicans view inflation as a problem, and it's not decreased. So he's sticking his head in the sand on this one, and that's going to cause the Republican Party more problems because they can't differentiate themselves from him. It's a quagmire.
John Geer, a political science professor, pollster at Vanderbilt University. Thank you so much, as always.
Thank you.
It's Here and Now.
It's All Things Considered coming up at 1 o'clock today.
Midterms are less than a year away, and election officials across the country are already preparing for the possibility of interference by the Trump administration.
At this point, I think we're all just kind of used to, all right, what's the next crazy hairball thing that's going to pop up?
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. What election officials are watching for as midterms draw closer on All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mina Kim. Wicked for Good is one of the cinematic events of the year. After Part 1 became one of the highest-grossing adaptations of a Broadway musical worldwide, on the evening of December 3rd in San Francisco, I'll sit down with Wicked director John Chu, also known for In the Heights and Crazy Rich Asians, to talk about his Bay Area roots and how his career has defied gravity. For tickets, go to kqed.org/live.
Support for KQED comes from Good Earth Natural Foods, serving the Marin community with organic holiday meals, turkeys, and more, with locations in Fairfax and Mill Valley, now offering curbside pickup and delivery. More at genatural.com. And support for KQED's card donation program comes from local Kia dealers announcing the Season of New Traditions event, going on now at local Kia dealers, offering a selection of SUVs, sedans, and hybrids. More info at kia.com.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and the Music Emporium. Guitar sellers for more than 55 years, celebrating the enduring presence of music made on the front porch and center stage. You can learn more at themusicemporium.com.
This is Here and Now. Phil Cook is a prolific musician and producer. This is his song Dawn Birds from his album Appalachia Borealis. The album is a suite of piano meditations that were inspired by and also feature bird songs. Cook says it began when he was alone, riffing at his windowside piano and taking in the sounds of the North Carolina woods around him. Cook has collaborated with a long list of artists, the Blind Boys of Alabama, Mavis Staples, Waxahachie, Megaphone, and Bon Iver. In fact, Bon Iver's Justin Vernon is a producer on this album. Appalachia Borealis is Phil Cook's sixth solo album and his second of songs for piano. I spoke to him back in April. So how did that bird song spark your creativity for this album?
You know, I got to make a record downtown in Durham at this beautiful tiny church that had a very tall nave, and it was a gorgeous 100-year-old piano. And there was a moment where I was playing a song called Queen of Branches, and we listened back to the recording, and there was a bird singing just outside the church, and it really struck me how symbiotic the tone and the cadence and the pitch and the song of this bird was hitting and duetting almost with the piano. It was a magical moment. It followed with me calling my childhood camp counselor, Alec Lindsay, who's a teacher, professor of ornithology up in University of Michigan. And I sent him the recording and said, "Please tell me, old friend, what pray tell is this bird?" You know, and he got back and said, "Well, that sounds to be a northern mockingbird." And it began a love affair with this particular bird and a fascination with songbirds in general. But, you know, a mockingbird will live up to 8 years in the wild, and they record, if you would just quote unquote, up to 200 different variant bird sounds, city sounds, anything that's in their environment, and they recall them for their own use, for mating, for defense, for different things, but each one has their own unique reel.
Wow.
And wherever I am now, I tune in and I always stop and I like listen to that mockingbird. And it's branched out to others, but that's like my main character. That's been my main muse.
What a great inspiration, especially for this new album. Let's listen to the song with the same name as the album, Appalachia Borealis. Phil Cook, you said in one interview, you could not have written this without real losses. Mind if I ask what you were going through at the time?
You know, Scott, it was, the hardship of the pandemic brought me home from the road for after 15 years. And I was roommates with my wife again. And unfortunately, our marriage ended, and it broke everybody apart, the kids, you know, her and I. And it was heartbreaking for everybody, obviously. And a lot of people listening have divorces touch their life and know how edifying that is. So Appalachia Borealis came during the lull of my life as I folded in my wings and remained very still. And what you hear in the background is a recording I made on my phone of a lake I grew up on northern Wisconsin.
There's the sound of a loon.
The common loon. It's like the sound of my life. That's kind of, I think, it predates the mockingbird. It predates any of this stuff. It's just a sound that's so haunting, and it makes me miss my home in Wisconsin because I live in North Carolina now for 20 years. So
yeah,
I know that I get to a place, you know, as an artist, when you feel yourself crack open and you meet yourself exactly where you are. And often in those moments, you know, with the piano, I'm left with tears streaming down my cheeks as I'm playing. And I know that's a sign to me that my body is telling me that I'm actually grieving right now. I'm actually like that's anything that's going on is working through me, and I can feel it. It's telling me, you know, so that was this song.
Yeah. Well, this is your project in collaboration with your old friend, producer Justin Vernon of Bon Iver. And I think we can hear his influence in some of the songs. We're going to listen now to the song Buffalo on your album. Did I read that this song is meant to evoke the idea of a hatchling, speaking of birds?
Yeah, it feels wide open to me. It feels like I'm driving, you know, through White Sands in New Mexico, through western Montana, through the woods and all the lakes in northern Wisconsin. The world is flying by, but it's wide open and new. And then you go to the micro and you just see that possibility that kind of evokes when you're in those precious moments where you're present.
We're talking to musician, pianist Phil Cook about his new album, Appalachia Borealis. And, you know, in your career, Phil Cook, you worked with a wide range of professional musicians. Hooray for the Riff Raff, Jess Williamson, the Blind Boys of Alabama, playing guitar, playing the banjo, marimba, the keys. This is not your first solo album, but as you go around and perform on piano, what is it like when it's just you out there?
Well, I remember my first recital. I was 5. These are these moments that have all this weight of expectation that usually is very crushing for, I would say, a majority of kids that are young. And there's
the
a solo piano,
my
the
goodness.
Pressure,
yeah.
And the recitation. And then the nerves and all the awareness that you have to ingest at the same time is enough to turn a large number of kids off to what I think would be a wonderful opportunity to build a lifelong relationship with an instrument. But playing in a rock band helped me to actually understand the communion that happens on stage and the dialogue with the crowd and how it all has to be there at the same time. Now when I play piano, I, in a way, want to subvert the recital that I was a kid in and make and break the fourth wall. I like to talk to the crowd. I like to tell stories, but I like to hear from people that have come to the show. The whole thing has felt so personal and honest and vulnerable. I get to play what I feel every night, and it's up to me. But people get a presence from me, and they get something very real from me. That's my aim.
Well, let me ask you about performing by asking you about one last song. One song on this album is your rendition of I Made a Lover's Prayer by Gillian Welch. Let's take a listen to that. Thank you. Cooke, when you're playing that song in front of an audience, what are you channeling?
You know, sometimes I get an image of a bird flying over an ocean, like fighting the wind, and rooting for it to make it across, you know, and how it feels in my hands, because my hands are interlocked on that song. They're very close together and overlapping. Mm. They look like a bird on the piano, you know? And so that was less of an overt bird song and more like my hands are birds. And I wrote it the day I bought my first piano. That was a real instrument. I was 43 years old. And the first thing that happened was that song, a song I've loved since that record came out and when I was 23 years old. You know, that song, I can still tap into it now. And it just calms me down and taught me about what music can give me in my life. And I am in turn relaying and telling people how much I love this music, how much I love music in general.
That's Phil Cooke talking about his album Appalachia Borealis. And here is just a little more, the song Ambassador Cathedral. And if you happen to be in Arkansas, Phil Cooke is performing at the Arkansas Museum of Fine Arts in Little Rock on December 11th. You're listening to Here and Now.
Live from NPR News in Boston, I'm Josie Guarino. Democratic Congressman Henry Cuellar of Texas is thanking President Trump for pardoning him and his wife in a federal bribery and conspiracy case. The president called the case politically motivated because Cuellar had spoken against Biden-era border policies. The Cuellars were accused of taking $600,000 in bribes from an Azerbaijani oil company and a Mexican bank. A federal vaccine advisory committee this week is expected to discuss whether newborns should still get the hepatitis B vaccine, the first shot found to prevent cancer. Federal health recommendations now suggest that all babies be vaccinated against the liver infection for their first day of life, but U.S. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s committee on Thursday is expected to change that. Changing the recommendation would contradict previous public health advice. President Trump is expected to announce a proposal to weaken automobile fuel efficiency standards. That's according to several people familiar with the White House plans. The proposal would ease pressure on automakers to control pollution from gasoline-powered cars and trucks. The move would be the latest action by the Trump administration to reverse Biden-era policies that encourage the sale of cleaner-running cars and trucks, including electric vehicles. This is Here and Now.
Support for KQED today comes from San Francisco International Airport, sharing some holiday sparkle with travelers through SFO shops. From perfumes to paperbacks and more, learn more about SFO shops at flysfo.com. And Landmark College, offering academic executive function and social coaching support for neurodivergent individuals at the Bay Area Success Center. Learn more at landmark.edu/successcenter. Offshore gusty winds at times today, especially in the North Bay and the Santa Cruz Mountains. The Weather Service says quiet weather starts tomorrow. It will continue into the weekend. No rain is forecast the next several days through the weekend.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and from the Mehrotra Institute at Boston University, hosting the Is Business Broken podcast, featuring conversations with academics, industry leaders, and politicians. More at ibms.bu.edu. And BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
It's here and now. A new survey of centenarians finds that people who make it to 100 are more socially engaged and physically active compared to results from a decade ago. As NPR's Allison Aubrey tells us, many of these seniors have taken up habits that younger people may find surprising.
If you ask a centenarian how old they feel, they're likely to say they feel decades younger at heart. This includes Robert Earl Jackson, who turned 100 this year.
Feel good, just feel good. Time just go by so fast.
There are about 100,000 centenarians in the U.S. right now, and that's expected to quadruple by mid-century. Jackson, who lives in Prince George's County, Maryland, says one key to a long life is to reframe your expectations.
I thank God for waking up a new day.
It's what centenarians are doing each day that's inspiring, says Dr. Rhonda Randall. She's the chief medical officer at United Healthcare, the group behind the new survey. They surveyed centenarians back in 2015 and again this year.
A decade ago, 34% said that they were doing strength training. Now it's 46% of people over the age of 100 are saying they're doing some type of strength training on a weekly basis.
36% say they participate in some kind of stress relief activity, like meditation or prayer. Many say they focus on a healthy diet. The survey also found 40% play video games regularly, and almost 1 in 3 have tried ChatGPT or another AI platform, showing curiosity about new technology.
I think one of the things that we can learn from these folks is that it's a holistic view of your health, right? It's not just one thing.
Randall says the importance of family and social connections really stands out. Nearly 80% of the centenarians say they get together with family and friends at least once a week.
If you look at the communities that have the greatest levels of social connection, you'll see lower rates of diseases, lower rates of chronic conditions, longer life expectancies. So I think all of that is important.
Dr. Jonathan Rosand is the co-founder of the McCants Center for Brain Health at Mass General Brigham. He says the survey is just a small sample of 100 centenarians, but it points to a growing focus and ability to keep up with the times.
They're putting a lot of cognitive energy into taking care of themselves in ways that are totally in the mainstream.
Successful aging is the result of lots of factors, including genes, access to good health care, income, and luck plays a role too. Dr. Roseanne says a big part of moving the needle towards a longer, healthier life does come down to daily choices.
What we've learned is that the core of successful aging is in the lifestyle choices we make every day. There isn't a magic pill.
What his research shows is the earlier in life that people adopt healthy habits, the more likely they are to fend off the common diseases of aging and thrive later in life. He says it's not just about living longer, it's about living better that matters most. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Today on our podcast, Here and Now Anytime, we'll try to answer some questions you might have about the government's new investment accounts for kids. They were funded by the Trump administration and most recently with a big donation from billionaires Michael and Susan Dell. Here and Now Anytime delivers the latest answers and questions to your device of choice every afternoon. Find the podcast wherever you listen. It's Here and Now.
Prices for everything from cars to coffee are soaring, but you can count on some things getting cheaper because they have been for decades. Computers. Storing and processing information has gotten more efficient and more cost-effective over time.
The number of transistors incorporated in a chip will approximately double every 24 months.
But will that last? On the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
We'll have more for you tomorrow morning, Morning Edition at 2 in the morning until 9 a.m. Later today at 2, the world, of course. Coming up this afternoon, an outbreak of African swine flu in Spain has prompted a lockdown in the region of Catalonia.
and a look at Jamaica's ongoing recovery efforts in the wake of the devastating Hurricane Melissa. Those global stories and much more at 2 on KQED News. Support for KQED comes from Genentech, the original biotech pioneer, forging life-altering scientific breakthroughs to help improve the lives of all patients. Learn more about Genentech's commitment to patients and society at gene.com/ourpromise. And support for KQED's car donation program comes from local Kia dealers. Donating a car or truck is easy. We'll arrange to have it picked up running or not in most cases. Invest the funds back into our news coverage. Also, you could be eligible for a year-end tax deduction. Learn more at kqed.org/cars.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and your NPR station. And from Viking, dedicated to creating travel experiences for the thinking person with programs designed for cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Learn more at viking.com. And MathWorks, creator of MATLAB and Simulink software for technical computing and model-based design. MathWorks, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. This is Here and Now. The tech company Anthropic says Chinese state-sponsored hackers used Anthropic's AI technology recently in cyber attacks on foreign governments and on major corporations. Hackers are finding they can rapidly scale up their operations with AI tools. Stephen Nader is president of the cybersecurity firm Velexity, which also has found Chinese-backed hackers using AI in their campaigns. And he joins us now. Stephen, hi.
Hey, yeah, great to meet you. Thanks for having me on.
So tell me a story here, simpler the better, of something a hacker does manually and how AI lets that hacker do the work better, faster, more efficiently.
In the simplest terms, AI, you know, it turns automation to a whole nother level. So instead of just saying, I'm going to write some tools and scripts to help me, you're going to have something that can potentially be a little more autonomous that will run, not just run the commands and get the output, it will run the commands, get the output, and interpret them, and then perhaps take further actions and maybe break into a system or decide something is, you know, valuable or not valuable. So essentially, it force multiplies like in an individual attacker, a set of attackers, a kind of, like I said, it's something they could do individually or on their own, but, you know, at a larger scale and obviously a lot faster.
Yeah. So help me maybe with an example or two. For example, can AI help a hacker draft the emails targeting a big company or targeting me, or kind of, you know, writing the malware to get into a system or making a list of possible targets? Give me a for instance or two.
Not only can I give you a for instance, I can give you some of the cases that Velexity worked on and also published recently. So we had a Chinese-aligned nation-state threat actor, so someone conducting hacking operations, cyber espionage. They kind of did a hacking campaign against several of our customers and beyond. So organizations that work on China policy, things related to Taiwan, things in the semiconductor space, or, you know, chips and other advanced technologies. And they send a series of what's called spear phishing emails. These are emails that are specifically written and designed to kind of attract them, have them open it, and their goal was to install malware on their computer so they could
get you to click a link so they could get in.
That is exactly what they did. So they made each one of the emails a little bit different. So it would be a long email that largely looked professionally written. It was relevant to the target. It would talk about their research. It might flatter them a bit. And they would say in the email, hey, we're from this institute. So we'd see like the Copenhagen Governance Institute. And as we started to look at these emails, they started to have kind of some, you know, mistakes in them.
And let me kind of pause you. What mistakes did you see?
Velexity came to the conclusion from our team that, hey, this is likely AI behind it because there would be small mistakes like name mismatches. So the firm address would say Laura Davis, but the email would say, you know, hi, I'm Lucas Tanaka. They'd say they represent this university, but they would reference a department that was non-existent. Phone numbers that didn't make sense. So like in the example of the Copenhagen example we gave, it would be the correct country code for Denmark. But then we would see the phone number would say 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 consecutive numbers that are, you know, extremely unlikely or just completely not legitimate.
Interesting. So does it suggest to you then that this AI is getting better. The wording of the emails seemed more human, seemed more sophisticated, wasn't cookie cutter. It's not perfect, but it's getting there.
At first glance, someone might think, oh, these simple mistakes, huh, AI is not very good. But this is actually really good, and if they just make a few small tweaks, you're talking about what will likely become very successful hacking campaigns.
So then when the bad guys send this email and try to get in, the bad guys also need a software, a malware, to get into the system, kind of probe around, find whatever treasured information the hackers want. Is that something, as far as you know, is also being automated using AI?
It is, or at least components of it anyway. So in these exact hacking campaigns, which we observed kind of taking place, you know, between mid-June and basically mid-September, at each one of the iterations, we would see that their malware would change. So it was being like rapidly developed, complete new functionality, new ways of communicating. And they did it really quickly, not incrementally, but fairly significantly in some cases.
So, Stephen, we're already hearing about so many hacking incidents, these scams being run by very sophisticated kind of organizations. When you add the AI efficiencies on top of this and assume the AI is going to get better, what is a clue into what the future looks like for possible victims, for the hackers, for what kinds of attacks we're going to be seeing?
Velocity works a lot on cyber espionage, where in particular we see threat actors from North Korea, Iran, China, Russia. They engage in conversation. They take over an identity or pretend to be someone and say, hey, I'm a reporter from this news organization. They reach out, I'd like to interview you. And they'll actually send four or five emails over days, weeks. And they'll move things over to actual phone calls. They'll go on Signal, WhatsApp. All of this with the end goal of getting someone to click a link and successfully phish them. They get access to their personal but often corporate emails. These interfaces, they are time-consuming, and we believe the majority of those very customized, tailored, one-on-one messages are largely human-driven at this point. But imagine the AI gets to the point where it can engage with like hundreds or thousands of people completely automated, send emails back and forth, do that over weeks or days. I think that's going to be very challenging for a lot of organizations to get that right all the time.
So Stephen, just kind of for us, the members of the public, regular people who are already the targets, what then should we be looking out for? Emails with persons pretending to be my friend, phone calls, text messages, social media, that's already coming. It's just going to be another level of complexity, another level of quantity, what?
The techniques are just being done faster at a larger scale, you know, and they're getting better. But the defense, you know, don't type your password, don't click the link, don't run the file, don't send money or buy gift cards for someone. We don't want to tell people to be paranoid, right? But be guarded, be a little bit more guarded of whenever something tells you to click something, to buy something, to download something. Just be aware that even now, last year, 10 years ago, that could have been malicious or fake. That's not going to go away, and it's probably potentially going to get worse and be a little bit harder to discern. So I think that's just the awareness factor.
That's Stephen Adair, president of the cybersecurity firm Velocity. Stephen, thanks for the time.
Yeah, thank you.
A researcher at Columbia University has been pondering a question. How can we keep younger public health workers on the job? NPR's Andrea Hsu explains why that's a pressing question.
Heather Kresna has been concerned about younger workers leaving the public health workforce. Why?
People under 35 have been more likely to leave the jobs that they've gotten in local or state government.
Kresna is Associate Dean of Career and Professional Development at Columbia's Mailman School of Public Health. She says state and local public health workers are the backbone of America's public health system.
These are the folks that are doing things that typical people don't notice and take completely for granted. So when you go and eat at a restaurant, you assume you're not going to die of salmonella poisoning. When you drink water, you assume that there's a system that keeps that water clean.
Now, Kresna works with data coming out of a national survey of public health workers conducted every 3 years. She says younger workers come to the field out of a desire to serve their communities, number one, and number two, for job security. COVID presented a real challenge to the workforce. Now the current political climate does too, with federal agencies like the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention seeing deep cuts, and money for state and local agencies also in peril.
They do get a lot of federal funding, and that funding is being cut. And so these roles have been also shaken up.
With job stability less of a sure thing, Kresna says it's all the more important that state and local governments emphasize good benefits, especially those that younger workers value, flexible schedules, remote work opportunities, and access to childcare. She notes roughly 3/4 of those 35 and under working in state and local public health are women.
So that's a pretty good explanation of why these particular benefits might be important to people.
In the private sector, Kresna says, companies often have more flexibility to offer workers bonuses as a retention tool. In the public sector, there are more rules dictating what someone can be paid. Still, she says, state and local agencies should do whatever they can to retain workers, including raising wages where possible.
You know, the thing with public health is that it's really invisible until something goes really wrong.
She says this is not a workforce you want to lose. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
It's Here and Now.
Support for KQED comes from the Watermark at San Jose, a senior living community providing assisted living and memory care with amenities like on-site restaurants, a fitness center and spa, and salon services. Learn more at sanjosewatermark.com. Xfinity delivering smart Wi-Fi, mobile, home security, and entertainment to help power a seamlessly connected life. Learn more at xfinity.com. Xfinity, imagine that. You're on KQED 88.5 San Francisco, KQEI 89.3 North Highland Sacramento. On our phone app, too, it's a free download on the KQED live phone app and on KQED.org.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and your NPR station, and from Rhodes Scholar, celebrating 50 years of transformative learning adventures for adults in over 100 countries. Learn more at rhodesscholar.org/explore. And CitySpace Productions, WBUR's creative studio for custom podcasts that tell a brand story to ignite engagement, reach new audiences, or establish thought leadership. WBUR.org/creative studio.
It's Here and Now with a food experiment that sounds a little sci-fi, but pretty delicious. Bacon made from a pig who's still happily wandering around the farm. A reporter at our editorial partner Grist tasted it, reported on it, and is on the line with us now. Matt Simon is here alive and well. Congratulations. Welcome.
I made it, man. Thank you as always.
Yeah, I'm a sucker for a good opening line. Can I have you read the first few sentences of your story?
Certainly. Here we go. I'm eating Dawn the Yorkshire pig, and she's quite tasty. But don't worry, she's doing perfectly fine, traipsing around a sanctuary in upstate New York. Word is that she appreciates belly rubs and sunshine.
All right. Dawn the Yorkshire pig. How did you eat her? What is happening here exactly?
Indirectly, as it happens. So what this product is known as cultivated product. So it's from a company called Mission Barns. It's based in San Francisco. They took a very small sample of fat from Dawn the pig and cultivated in a device called a bioreactor. And it essentially replicates the conditions inside Dawn's body to get that fat to grow. They then take that fat product and combine it with plant-based materials within something like a meatball or a piece of salami. So it's mixing in that fat, and then because we get so much of the flavor of meat from fat, they can get a really good approximation of the real thing from something that's at its core plant-based with just this cultivated fat added in.
Wow, so you had this bacon and meatball and salami. How did it taste?
It tasted pretty darn close to the real thing. I was actually racking my brain for a couple of weeks here after trying it, trying to describe it. And the best thing that I've come up with is that it's diet meat. So Diet Coke is an approximation of the real thing. It doesn't quite taste like the real thing, not necessarily in a bad way. This just tastes a little bit less meaty. But because this is a so-called unstructured product, like a meatball is very different from a pork loin, which has all these very complicated structures, they can mix in all sorts of different spices and get really close to what you would think a pork product should taste like if it were, you know, grown in a vat, at least partially so.
What's the vision here? I mean, are we heading towards a place where this happens on a large scale? Is that nearby? Is that close?
I think so. There are a number of companies that have been working on this, not just pork, but all sorts of other meats being grown in these bioreactors, beef and chicken. There are other companies working on fish products. The challenge here is that it remains very expensive to do this, obviously, but I think the power in it is that you can scale it up, I think, pretty well, meaning you have to have a pork farm somewhere outside of city limits, you know, and then it takes energy to process that pork and send it to cities in trucks and things like that. The promise of cultivated meat is you could actually site these facilities closer to urban centers, and that cuts down on shipping costs and the energy associated with it. What they're up against here is that there has been a general pullback in the alternative meats market. So like Impossible Foods and Beyond Burger, I think as American consumers have really turned on processed foods, these products have begun to suffer from that. Mm. So hard to tell what's in the years ahead, but I think there's a lot of power to it.
You know what I think is so interesting about this is that I know a lot of people specifically who won't eat pork because they don't want to kill an animal, but especially one as intelligent as a pig. Does this solve that problem for people like that, for vegetarians?
I think it would in some cases. This is the real big question here is who is this product for? Is it for vegetarians and vegans who object to eating meat because of the animal cruelty considerations? Or is it more for flexitarians, which are people who generally stay away from meat but have it every once in a while but are typically more plant-based? The early research, at least by this company, Mission Barnes, they're looking more at the flexitarians being interested in this, that there are considerations around the animal cruelty that, not necessarily turn people off entirely from eating meat, but maybe more willing to venture into these sorts of new foods, which really do cut down on the, of course, animal cruelty, because Don is, jaunting around a sanctuary in upstate New York still.
Okay, that gets me to my final question, because you say that Dawn is fine, and she's really cute. I mean, we've got pictures at hereandnow.org. But are there any other ethical questions that we should be grappling with here?
I think ethically, we're not talking about harm to this animal. This is an extremely small sample of fat that they got from Dawn. So there's no worry about Dawn. But we have to really be careful that we don't jump headlong into these sorts of new products without doing proper assessments. And by that, I mean, we need to make sure that these are indeed more efficient. So are they, in fact, using, you know, less energy than the traditional livestock market? The early indications are that, yes, if you can run these facilities on renewable energy, you are going to be saving energy on that sort of thing. Important to keep in mind that depending on who's doing the estimation, the livestock industry is responsible for somewhere between 10 and 20% of humanity's carbon emissions, which is pretty huge. So I don't think there's a future in which these products fully replace meat, but I think for a lot of people, they might be willing to experiment with this, especially because it tastes darn close to the real thing.
Matt Simon, senior writer with Grist, who's had bacon from the pig Dawn, and she's fine. She's good. Matt, thank you.
And thanks as always.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and from StoryWorth. Each week, StoryWorth emails a loved one a question about their life. After a year, StoryWorth will publish their stories and color photos into a book to keep for generations. Learn more at StoryWorth.com.
This week at KQED.org, Bay Area electricity bills are some of the highest. But where does that money go? Reporter Laura Clivens breaks down the charges on one bill on KQED.org. Our community showed up big for Giving Newsday. Thank you very much. So Arthur and Tony Remby Rock are keeping it going. Your gift today will be matched dollar for dollar up to $20,000. Let's turn up the volume on public media together at kqed.org/donate. All things considered in a minute. Now Julie Depish with afternoon traffic.
It looks like a solo spin out Petaluma on northbound 101 before East Washington Street. The vehicle was slammed into the center divide. Roadworks are slowing things down out of Martinez and Highway 4 westbound at Center Avenue. There are alternating lane closures there until tonight. Right now, the backup to Morello Avenue. Be on the lookout if you're in Millbrae, southbound 280. On the off-ramp to Truesdale Drive, a stalled taco truck blocking the left turn lane. Julie Depish for KQED.
Thank you, Julie. Traffic support comes from Murphy McKenna Construction Custom Home Builders. Support for KQED comes from Kaiser Permanente, where their doctors, hospitals, and health plans are designed to work together to help their members live healthy lives. Kaiser Permanente, a better idea for healthcare.